Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For years, Sherry Turkle has been deeply examining how digital technology is changing human connections and relationships. The promise was deeper connectivity, but Turkle instead found more isolation. As she put it, we were alone together. Well, now, hundreds of millions of people are literally isolated, safe physical distancing to flatten that curve of coronavirus infections. And in this new world of ours, technology has become the medium to maintain social connections. So given that, we wanted to know what Sherry Turkle is seeing and thinking, and what she believes this moment means, and how it might shape human connections and relationships. And Sherry Turkle is a professor of program in science, technology, and society at MIT. She's also the founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, and author of several books about this, including Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, and Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And she joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Sherry Turkle, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It is great to talk with you, Professor Turkle. And first of all, as we've been trying to remember to do with as many guests as I can remember, we want to check in. How are you doing in this age of physical distancing so far?
I'm doing fine. I have my typical winter scratchy throat, and people are so solicitous of me, I have to kind of calm them down that I always have this from October to April, and it's nothing. But I've never gotten so much love and attention and people begging me to take my temperature. But I'm really fine.
Okay, so health-wise, fine, which I'm delighted to hear.
Health-wise, fine, but I have that Lauren Bacall sound, but it's just my typical Lauren Bacall sound.
Great for the radio.
Great for the radio.
And what about socially? I mean, I imagine that your social calendars and those in-person connections have gone way down.
Way down. Well, but it's funny. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is that I'm booked. Everybody is booked. We're connecting more than ever. I'm Zooming all day. I have meetings. I have sub-meetings. I have teaching. I have office hours. I have faculty meetings. I have curriculum meetings of the meetings. I mean, I'm working on a book. I have meetings with my editor. I have meetings about the illustrations. I mean, what's very interesting about this time is that, in a way, I would almost say there's a ramping up of a kind of connection, and yet we feel more alone than ever before. I mean, so there's a lot of, the reason I was so interested in coming on the program and chatting is I think that there's a kind of confusion about how we feel, because so many of us are in a kind of paradoxical state where we're constantly connected, yet never so alone,
right,
as before.
Yeah, so help us to see through the fog of this confusion, because I think you're spot on. I mean, I'll just reflect on my own experience. Even though I do get to actually still come into the building where I work, there are very, very few of us here, first of all. I think it's like 10% of our regular staff is in the building. And then other than that, it's just between here and home. But like you said, like, I have been on a lot of Zoom meetings, doing FaceTime with people way more than I ever used to. I have a friend who,
absolutely,
she's banned me from texting her. She's like, I want to stay in contact much more profoundly, so we're going to do it face-to-face through FaceTime. And I'm feeling the sense of the profound gratitude for those connections right now, but B, also a little exhaustion.
Right. I think we're all feeling exhausted because, you know, there's some sense that you can't say no. I mean, now to say no to someone who wants to FaceTime you because they want to check in on you is really churlish. I mean, that really is bad. To say no, you can't check in on me. I mean, when people reach out now, that needs to be honored and cherished. But so people are kind of, I was with a group of students yesterday and sort of asking them, we began by going around and saying, well, how is everybody doing? And people, you know, almost to a one, people were saying, oh, this is exhausting. You know, there's these parental calls where, you know, we really, you know, you can't say no. I mean, of course your parents want to check in, but really every day, every day to say I'm fine, it's a little much. So I think that, and yet we're so grateful. I mean, I'm laughing because we're so grateful for realizing how many people care about us and love us and want to be there for us.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I think we're really at a moment of the churning around of a lot of emotions. And one of the things that's happening is I think that we see both the strengths and the limitations of the online life.
Right. So I'm just jumping here, Professor Turkle, for a second.
Right.
Because that dichotomy of strengths and limitations is very much what I want to explore with you. But we did hear from a lot of listeners about how they've embraced the use of technology to maintain social connections, and also
yes,
how it's complicated as well. So I just wanted to play for you a little bit from one of our listeners. This is Mary from New Orleans. And she told us about how weekly Sunday dinner with her siblings and father has gone online.
My Sunday, we couldn't go over to Dad's house. And so we did it from our homes. And again, we got 6 out of the 7 siblings. And I'm sure we'll get all 7 hopefully next Sunday. But it's really great because actually my husband goes to see his elderly parents at their house on Sundays. So he was able to be part of the video chat. And interestingly, his parents have no computer or smartphones. So the best I've done is wave at his mother from the driveway.
That's Mary from New Orleans. Now, Sherry Turkle, you have spent many years just deeply examining sort of the quality of human relationships when they're
right,
when they pass through an online medium. I mean, I like to play Mary's tape there because right now that's kind of all we have. So,
right.
I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I mean, this is, you know, on the one hand, so many of us associated online medium with polishing our avatars, with, you know, taking the perfect picture of our pasta to post on Instagram, you know, with lying about our life on so we could put it on Facebook in exactly the right way. And now we're seeing that when we put our minds to it and when we have reason to, we can really use this medium to reach toward as much authenticity as possible. And that's what I like about what's happening, is that people are using the medium to have as human an experience on it as they possibly can, as opposed to using the medium to, you know, buff up their presence, you know, as I say, you know, polish their avatar, you know, make their friends jealous.
Yeah.
I mean, now they're in, you know, you begin to see people using it very creatively.
Well, I think this is, I'm just going to jump in here because I think this, to me, this is one of the most positively surprising things about the moment we're in, because that change happened very quickly. I mean, just to underscore what you're saying, I mean, I haven't heard anyone talking about using technology or social media for projection now. Rather, everyone's talking about it, as you're saying, for actual connection with small groups of people, one-on-one.
Yes. Yes. And so that, I think, is really the piece of, or the whole thing about how much screen time and how much not screen time. There's nothing, which was such a silly debate. I mean, there's nothing wrong with screen time if you're using it for, you know, for meaningful connection. When I use my screen time to write my books, it's my creativity. It's the deepest part of me. I don't want somebody to tell me I can't revise a chapter because that's too much screen time. I mean, it was not a constructive conversation. Mm. So I think that's the positive side. But I also think that what you're getting in these constructive uses of screen time to bring people together is that people are also yearning for each other physically.
Right.
That's also happening. And we're brushing against the limitations of not being there with each other. And I think that people are developing a more subtle and significant appreciation of what it is to be with each other. For example, the silences that are possible when you're just with each other, and you don't have to talk, you don't have to have a conversation, you don't have to say something to your mother, you don't have to answer questions about what you're doing. You're just cooking together. You're just being together. And some of the nicest, some of the nicest interactions that people are having on FaceTime, I think the most realistic, is they just set up the FaceTime in the kitchen, and each of them are sort of cooking something in their own kitchen, and just being together, separately, but doing something just with the presence of the other person. But I think that makes us yearn for each other.
So apart but not alone.
Apart but not alone, exactly. So I think that on the one hand, you're having this connection, and the connections are more meaningful online because we need each other and miss each other. And yet I think we're deepening our appreciation for how much we got out of the presence of each other. Yeah. I mean, I just had several Zoom classes yesterday that I taught, and I physically missed my students. Mm-hmm. I love those students. They're funny. They're wonderful. Their interactions with each other are fantastic. And there they were, kind of postage stamps.
Yeah.
And I missed them, and they missed each other, I think.
Well, Professor Turkle, hang on here for just a second, because we're going to take a really quick break. And there's a lot more about relationships as mediated through technology now that I want to explore with you. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Sherry Turkle. She's a professor in the program of science, technology, and society at MIT, and for years has studied how technology, and specifically digital technology, is changing human relationships. She's written a couple of books about that, called Reclaiming Conversation, and another, Alone Together. And we're hearing Professor Turkle this hour walk us through what she sees right now as technology is kind of becoming one of those lifelines to keeping social connections alive. Professor Turkle, before the break, you were talking about physically missing your students. And that reminded me that, I'm going to admit this out loud, but I love text messaging, right? Because I get to control the flow of information. I can answer when I want. I don't have to answer. I can ignore people or send back a little sort of easy emoji, right? I mean, it's like it's that frictionless communication, which people have discussed before. But what I've noticed now is that even though I am yearning for face-to-face contact, so I'm texting a lot less and FaceTiming more, mm-hmm. What I'm missing, even with those FaceTimes, is something that is only available when I'm physically present with someone else. I'm missing the feeling of being like held by that person's gaze. You know, because I can just immediately look away from the screen and that sort of magic of the connection is broken. But that magic is not broken when I'm actually in the same room as someone. So there's still real limitations to answering that yearning, I think, that people have.
Yes, absolutely. It has to do with efficiency. It has to do with, you know, where we live in an engineering culture. And we live in a culture where we kind of worship technology and we worship this wonderful new, digital technology that came our way and made everything, was a miracle. We wrote better. We had this fantasy we could do anything better. It was like our magical bracelets. It was our cape. It became everything to us. And we had this fantasy that everything would be more efficient, including our relationships. And that's where we kind of drank the Kool-Aid, because relationships really aren't meant to be efficient. It's kind of the thing you don't learn until you've been in some. That relationships are really meant to have stops and starts, and it's when I'm sure you learn it as an interviewer. You know, it's when people stumble over their words a little bit that they reveal something truer about themselves. It's not always the person who comes on the radio and gives you the smoothest answer, you know. it's sometimes when they search for a word and you have to ask the question twice, and then they stumble and they come up with something. That's for me as an interviewer, that's when I know that I'm hearing something that really is of the person.
Oh, without a doubt. Always. I would say always. I mean, when someone sounds like they're talking from bullet points, they usually are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, right. And that's the friction-filled conversation.
Yeah.
And when we're looking for friction-free, we're often not in a real conversation. We're in a connection. We're not in a conversation. And we've gotten so used to, through texting and email and being able to edit ourselves and curate ourselves, we've gotten used to our relationships being connections rather than conversations and being curated. And we got too used to it. And I think that now we're seeing when now we can have all of our relationships be like that. Everything can be texting and everything can be sort of perfect. I can be having email. I can do everything on email and everybody can think I'm perfect as I sit here in my, you know, isolation booth. We miss the authenticity.
Well, but
you're really with somebody.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because I think the thing is that people are missing that. Right? They are now realizing, or many people at least, that like what you're saying, oh my God, the life is in the friction.
Exactly. The life is in the friction. And I think that if anything good comes from that, so I don't want to take away that people are doing positive things with this technology in this moment of distress. I want to honor that. I want to say it's a true phenomenon. I mean, I really have noticed it and I'm studying it and I'm impressed by it and it has to happen and I'm so excited by it. I listen every day to Yo-Yo Ma do a cello, a song on a cello, and it is one of the most moving things that happens. I mean, it's such an authentic sharing of who he is. Patrick Stewart reading a Shakespeare sonnet every day. Such an authentic moment of sharing something. I mean, people are really reaching deep to, and I want to honor that. But we are missing the friction.
Right.
And I think that one good thing that could come out of this is that we come out of this honoring that friction in our teaching, in our relationships with our physicians, in our relationships and our families, what a family dinner is about when you can actually be there having an argument with your family over dinner, you know, a real conversation. And what I fear is that too many people will come out of it and too many institutions will come out of it and say, you know what, virtual classrooms, these Zoom classrooms, we can save money on that. How many of these classrooms can we put on Zoom? That could be a good thing.
Uh-huh.
Not all of them, but some of them. And I think it's important that we remember to push back
right.
if institutions point us in that direction.
I think that's a really interesting and important flag to raise, because I can imagine some institutional change in that direction, right? I mean, like you said, they're going to say, well, look at how much we were able to accomplish under these less than ideal circumstances. Maybe they ought
yes.
to become de facto how we operate. But perhaps people will push back on that, because the very thing that might make it more efficient for institutions, as you and I are discussing, is the thing that makes it completely inadequate for human beings, the individuals
yes.
who make up that institution.
Yes. And I think, you know, we've been moving, you know, as we chat with Siri and Alexa about our personal problems, as we've recently, there's been a push to do, you know, kind of chatbot psychotherapy. And I mean, there've been all kinds of proposals to use, you know, robot chat for advice and to give elderly people, you know, robots as companions, and be all in the name of a more friction-free, efficient way of managing human moments,
yeah.
moments in the human life cycle.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of is a sort of hits the pause button. Not that we wanted this pause button hit, but we've been forced to hit the pause button as a whole culture, as a world, and say, you know, what is the value of the human to human? What did we miss when we had all the technology and all the technological mediated conversation we could ever want? And I think it's really a moment to reflect on that.
Yeah. Well, Professor Terkel, I have to say, like, the other thing that I'm noticing from my own sort of modifications of daily life here is that humanity runs up, or the need for human connection runs up against the sort of human factors limitation of technology. You know, I was mentioning eye contact before. The reason why
yeah.
it's so easy to break eye contact with even the face that I'm seeing on the screen is because that person is looking at the screen. I'm looking at my screen. No one's looking at the camera. So essentially, we are not making eye contact with each other. That's a really
right.
big difference. And we've had callers call in about how they're seeking sort of even more elemental human ways to stay connected. And it has to do with the
mm-hmm.
human voice. So I want to just play some of what our listeners told us. For example, this is Bridie from Virginia. And Bridie cited research that suggests the human voice actually makes us feel better than communicating merely through text.
I've been making phone calls every day to dear friends, family, and even casual friends that I often only communicate with on Facebook. So the phone call is doing it for me these days.
It's a good old-fashioned phone call. Well, listener Lynn from Eureka, California, also left us this message about how she's reconnecting with old friends.
I've done a couple of Zoom meetings and so forth and other online venues. And what I'm finding is I just want to talk to people on the phone. It's not feeling very satisfying. Connecting online to me, you know, just cursorily here and there is fine. But when I really want to connect to people, I found myself picking up my phone book. Yes, some of us still have one of those. And going through and calling people that I haven't talked to in a while, who are some of my beloved friends and families.
Well, that's Lynn from Eureka, California. Sherry, is there something about kind of going back to brass tacks for like basic technology keeping us more connected?
I am so on board with this. I have written chapters about this, that in going to text, again, because of efficiency, we have lost, we have forgotten the power of the human voice, because because it's as though we said, oh, I know the problem with voices. It's not asynchronous, and that's not efficient. You have to be there at the same time. I don't like that. That's why we left. That's why we left voices, because we all have to be together. And people said that that's not efficient. I want something where I don't have to be there at the same time. I can just be anywhere. I don't have to worry about scheduling a time together. Plus, in my interviews, people said things like, the trouble with talking on the phone is that you never know what the person is going to say, and you have to respond on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the giving up of the phone is part of a flight from conversation that was based in people not wanting to feel vulnerable.
Right.
We're getting now into the rediscovery of the voice and of conversation. You have to say, well, why people are rediscovering it, but why did we leave something so rich and so nurturing? And it has to do again with the wanting things to be efficient and forgetting what is nurturing to the human.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't want to feel vulnerable. And people didn't want that feeling of being put on the spot and being vulnerable.
Right. Well, now it seems like we're all realizing that there are whole other types of vulnerability that are worse than being vulnerable on the telephone, right? There's this whole like global vulnerability to a pandemic, and it suddenly turns out, oh, those awkward moments on the phone are far to be preferred than living this.
Yeah, but people are also discovering that it's only in vulnerability that you have real connection and real empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I would go further than what you're saying. I would say that, yes, that's true, and three steps more, that it's only in those moments of vulnerability that you have real connection and real empathy, that you can't have the closeness that we're all seeking unless we go back to being willing to be vulnerable and being willing to reveal ourselves as vulnerable.
Right. Well, let me.
That's what's wrong with reading your bullet points, because that's what makes that a not good, you know, people can be competent in an interview like that, but you're not hearing them as people because they're not willing to be vulnerable to you and really show you who they are. They'll show you what they learned.
Well, you wrote an entire book about reclaiming conversation, right? And so
yes.
What would you tell people now? I mean, sometimes I find myself in these FaceTime talks. Honestly, I don't have much to say, mostly because life is very much the same from day to day right now. But what are steps that people can take to sort of allow that vulnerability, reclaim those connections, even for as long as it has to be through a screen or over a phone?
Well, you know, it has to do with getting out of the habits that we've developed really over more than a decade now of our asynchronous, our safe asynchronous lives. And to say, look, I recognize now my need for something else. And to realize that you're discovering something really very positive about yourself. You're not discovering a flaw or something that a tragedy has cornered you into. this tragedy has helped us rediscover something profoundly human in ourselves that we've used technology to cover over and not get it, and now we're getting reconnected to. You know, it's not, I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't like pandemics to, you know, I don't like pandemics to show me positive things about the human spirit. That's not my, you know, that's not my thing. But it turns out that we're discovering something that is very positive about who we are. And that positive thing is that the friction-filled life and the embrace of conversation is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And it's time to get back into it.
Well, we're going to talk more about how we do that for as long as we're not sure when we can end this era of physical distancing. So Sherry Turkle, stand by for just a moment. There's a lot more to have a conversation about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking with Sherry Turkle. She's a professor in the program of Science, Technology, and Society at MIT and author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, and also of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And we're talking with Professor Turkle today because of the historic situation we all find ourselves in, where, in a sense, technology is becoming a lifeline to maintain human connections. But what kind of connections are those? That's what we're exploring today. So, Professor Turkle, let's listen to an On Point listener. This is Sandy, who called us from Boston, Massachusetts, and she told us about the work that she's doing as a communications specialist facilitating dialogue.
For the most part, we've shunned the idea of online dialogue because it's just not quite the same as face-to-face. And of course, it's not the same. You're not looking people eye to eye. You don't see as much body language. People tend to multitask, so you don't always have their full attention. And relationship building just doesn't feel as solid or as real. But it's valuable for engaging larger numbers of people and bringing people together across geographic boundaries. But it's interesting, now that everyone has been asked to stay at home and to work from home too, if they're lucky, people across the dialogue field have really jumped to the task of helping people have better conversations online.
That's Sandy from Boston, Massachusetts. So, Sherry Turkle, do you think it is possible to substantially increase the quality of the kinds of conversations we're having online right now?
Absolutely. Because it's, you know, when you... We haven't been working to optimize. That's what I meant before when I said, you know, people are now having experiences online where they're not just trying to polish their avatar or show their best face forward on Instagram. I mean, we haven't. We're now turning our attention to saying, you know, how can we use this in the best possible way? And there will be efforts, and good for her, to use this in the best possible way. My fear is that we, at the end of the day, and that should happen, but at the end of the day, I think we need to be vigilant that we maximize this medium And then also say, where, even with it maximized, where do we want to make sure that we still get the benefit of face-to-face conversation?
Mm-hmm.
So that, for example, the fact that you can have institutions will be able to do dramatic cost cutting because now they feel they're dealing with a maximized product. Consumers, patients, students should be able to turn to their universities and to their physicians and say, I still want real face-to-face classrooms. I still want real face-to-face office visits.
Right.
So that is my concern. I never want to, you know, I'm no Luddite. I always want technology to maximize what it can do. But then I always want to be able to say, and now what is this really good for? You know, what do we really want it to do? What are really our human purposes? It's not to stop technology from doing the best it can do. It's to then say, but what is it really good for after it can do its best?
So can I just dovetail off what you just said? Because earlier you talked about how even though in a sense we're sort of in this technological Shangri-La at the moment, we can use technology for literally almost anything that we want regarding communication, much more so than we could before. People are still feeling alone, as you said. And,
yes.
And I think that's absolutely true. So peer, if you would be willing to, peer into the distant future for us.
Yes.
Because, you know, technology will continue its progression forward. And, you know, for example, I'll give you an example. There's a lot of interest in coming up with robotic assistance for, say, senior citizens or folks who are homebound. If we're right now, we're already feeling alone, is it a chance to rethink, well, what can that robotic technology, what purpose can it actually fulfill 10, 20, 30, 40, 30 years down the line if we're looking for it to be a companion for human beings?
Right. Well, this is an area in which I've done a lot of work. And I think that there's a big push to give robotic technology to the two most vulnerable age groups, the very young as a kind of babysitter technology to children, and to the very old as a sort of babysitter technology to senior citizens. And I now remember, these are technologies that when they're in conversation with you, for all the fact that they can mimic a conversation and fool you into thinking that they're having a conversation with you, they have no idea what you've said. There's no meaning in the conversation for them. There's no empathy in the conversation for them. But they're good enough to fool you into a kind of sense of pretend empathy. And that's a very important distinction. It's that they can fool you into thinking that you're having a meaningful conversation. And that's true even now. So I've studied seniors who were in a conversation and the senior says, I'm sad. And the robot says, I'm sorry that you are sad. And the question is, what is the value, the human value? What is our compact with our grandparents, with our great-grandparents, to give them a meaningful conversation if we give them an object that has that has no idea what what kind of conversation it's in? And my turning point on this, I must say, I had an experience that was an epiphany. I was working with a woman. This was not a woman who had dementia. It was a woman who had lost a child many years ago, an adult child. And she turned to this robot and she talked about the loss of her child, of a son. and the robot indicated sadness. And the woman tried to comfort the robot and said, yes, it was sad. And sort of, you know, the way you would comfort someone you just told a sad story to and said, yes, you know, I've gotten over it. You know, thank you for your understanding. And I had a moment of crisis because everyone around was so happy that we had gotten this older woman to talk to the robot. But no one had heard this woman. She was not understood. There was no emotional connection. She had been fooled into thinking that there was a connection. So my position is that as we become better at fooling ourselves in this area of companionship, as we become better at fooling ourselves into thinking that we are in dialogue with machines, we have to behave very carefully and very ethically, because we are such cheap dates that we can be so easily fooled.
Well, Professor I've got to ask you, though. I'm very, very taken by what you said about the idea of this compact that we have as human beings with each other. Is it not entirely possible, we've just got about 2 minutes here, but is it not entirely possible that this moment that we're all experiencing together is reminding us of the basic importance of that compact?
I hope so, because I'm all for robots that can warn, you know, that will warn people that a senior is in trouble, that a senior has fallen, that will play chess with older people, that will warn them of danger. In other words, using technology in a lot of ways is fine. But having a robot that says to a senior, I love you, I care about you, tell me about the children who have died, tell me about your... This is to me, something that needs to be looked at ethically in the most serious ways. It's as though we've lost touch. We don't trust that we still could have a social service, you know, infrastructure where we could have visits, where we could have infrastructure, where we could have communities. And to me, this is about the breakdown of community in this country, and the breakdown of family and the breakdown of community. And I'm very, very skeptical and very sad to see that a robotics industry, a sociable robotics industry, is moving into that place. Well, and I'm hoping this is a moment where we say, no, this, what I want now in my loneliness is not a robot. I want to see my friends. I'm with you there.
I think that's entirely possible. I really do. Because, I mean, as you and I have been talking about, and as we've been hearing from our listeners for weeks now, that while they're grateful for the connections that are coming with the technology, everyone I've talked to has been saying, and now I realize also that it's not enough. And right. So that's the thought that I'm going to leave us both with, Professor Terkel, if I
Hallelujah moment.
Well, Sherry Terkel is a professor in the program of science, technology, and society at MIT and author of Reclaiming Conversation and also of Alone Together. Professor Terkel, it's been great to have you. Thank you so very much.
A pleasure.
Well, in a moment, we're going to talk about how it's been hard to stick with exercise routines in lockdown, but folks are still finding ways to stay fit. We'll hear from one runner in France about what he's doing. This is On Point. Well, France is taking extreme measures to curb the coronavirus. Confinement is now a way of life for French residents, including this man.
My name is Elisha Nochomovitz. I am 32 years old, and I'm living in Balma, near Toulouse, in the south of France. I stopped smoking since 7 years ago, and running saved my life. So I start running to beat myself, to be better than yesterday. So running is just my therapy, you know.
Well, so how does someone in confinement enjoy that therapeutic activity? Well, Alicia ran a 6-hour marathon entirely on his 23-foot-long balcony.
You know, I'm a crazy guy. I already ran 36 marathon. So for this one, I was trained for the Barcelona marathon, and it was canceled by the coronavirus. So I decided to run on my balcony. I tell to my girlfriend, I would like to run a marathon on my balcony. She said, you are crazy, but I know you are crazy. That's the reason I am with you. But first, start cleaning your balcony. So I make some cleaning in the morning, I eat, and then I start to run. At first, it was not a marathon. It was only just maybe, you know, 10 kilometers. It will be okay because my balcony, it's very tiny. So it's not very easier to run. I sent video on Instagram and I received so many messages of encouragement and support. Everyone was behind me, so it was a real race with virtual encouragement. So my girlfriend is my best partner. She was always here when I had maybe to have another shirt when it was too sweet. She gave me drinks, she gave me strawberry because at the end it was a little bit hard. I had a little headache because 6 hours, it's very difficult. But she was already here to take picture, take video. She is a beautiful, beautiful people for sure. I love running. And I wanted to show it's possible to run even if you are at home. And I received a lot of message of people who were running in the stairs, around the house, in the garden. So I said, oh, I can have a positive influence. It's incredible. All medical staff are doing an extraordinary job for everyone. They are saving our lives for us. And the message, it's stay at home. So I decided also to pay tribute to all the staff medical because I cannot work in the hospital with them. I decided to show to everybody that it was possible to stay at home and make sport. I can send you a lot of greeting from France to everyone to be strong in this situation. It's a difficult moment for everyone, but even if we are alone at home, we can be together, and you can be together with positive attitude.
Alicia Nahomovitz speaking to us from his home in Balma, France. Now, a week after that first balcony marathon that Alicia ran with the help of his girlfriend, Marie, he ran a much longer marathon on his balcony, as if you thought it was possible, but it was. It was a total of 50 kilometers, and he ran it in 6 hours and 29 minutes, beating his first balcony run. And again, remember, that balcony is 23 feet long. So someone out there do the math about how many times he had to run back and forth across that 23-foot space. We're talking about the coronavirus pandemic and its impact on the nation, what it means for the economy, our communities, and all of us. And we're working hard to shine a light on the way ahead. So tell us your story or leave us your questions at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amada, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Kotsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Roth, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.